I asked them, well, are you arresting me? And they said, yeah, I'm afraid so.
This is Stephen K. Bannon of Breitbart News. You are listening to American Patriots Radio with Jason W. Hoyt.
They took me to the jail. I was booked in on the charges. 40 years of my life, I was so busy trying to do what I thought was right and what was expected of me that I didn't pay attention to those who weren't doing what was right and not doing what they was expected of them. That's where I went wrong. That's what I'm trying so hard to correct now. I was called upon by my government to perform a duty. I swore to do that duty. I received a sacred trust from the public. I tried to carry that trust through exactly the way my government told me I had to do it. And at every point, my government failed me. It's depressing to think that we've allowed our government to devolve to this level of corruption.
Welcome to American Patriots Radio. My name is Jason W. Hoyt. You can find out more about the program at jasonwhoyt.com. That's Jason W. H-O-Y-T.com. Today's a very special episode. You know, I've been breaking some news lately, reporting about what's going on in Florida and really across the country. It essentially started with, I'm writing a book called How to Save Our Republic, America's War on Statism. And I did a blog post, which I'm going to include a link in this show's post to that original article where it's kind of an excerpt from the book. And it includes a thought process I've been going through some research that there's got to be other ways to hold our elected officials accountable besides waiting every 2 years. What has done for me is really gained a lot of perspective on our founders' original intent. And, you know, and we the people, we think, you know, the only way we can hold them accountable is by waiting every 2 years for an election. And that's just not the case. And so there's been this growing movement, this awakening, this awareness of how things are supposed to work. And one of those facets is where these grand juries under common law, through the Fifth Amendment, the presentment power. I mean, here we have the Magna Carta. We have centuries of history of common law in England. We have grand juries throughout our founding. We have the Fifth Amendment of the United States that talks about the presentment or indictment by a grand jury. We have example after example through decades into our founding. We have all the way to the 1992 U.S. Supreme Court, U.S. versus Williams, where Antonin Scalia talked about the grand jury as a function outside the branches of government. We have all this information right under our noses, and we haven't been doing that. And there's reasons why, and I include that in that original blog post. But then I find this case in Dixie County where the people have stood up and a man got arrested. Well, I had the opportunity and I was honored to spend so much time with him. And, you know, we intended to kind of record an interview, 15, 20 minutes or so. And thank you, Terry, for opening up and for, you know, sharing so much. And I'm going to play that interview in just a moment. And here's the thing. I'm going to put this show's blog post on a special link, jasonwhoyt.com/grand jury, all one word, all together, jasonwhoyt.com/grand jury. And that link will take you right to the show's blog post. And if you can't hear the whole thing in one sitting, because this is relatively long, but it's important, you got to hear this whole story. It's fascinating. Come back to it. You know, remember where you left off, come back to it. And share this with your family, friends, neighbors, coworkers. This is so important. Number one, it's a compelling story. But number two, this is a man who takes his oath seriously, who was selected to do this, took an oath, went home, did some research, understood what great responsibility was on his shoulders, and has been trying to navigate this corrupt system, this cronyism. I mean, there's so many words to describe what he's been facing. And God bless this man. Please pray for him. I don't know what's going to happen next with him, but I will keep you up to date. Again, this show's blog post will be at jasonwhoyt.com/grandjury. It'll be a quick link to the show's blog post. I'm going to have a bunch of information in there. And on that page, I even have a form where you can sign up to receive alerts to stay up to date with this story. Or you can actually send a message to Terry Trussell himself, and I'll make sure that message gets to him. Again, that's jasonwhoyt.com/grandjury, all one word. jasonwhoyt.com/grandjury. Here is my interview with Mr. Terry Trussell from Dixie County, Florida. Terry, I want to thank you so much, first off, for taking the time and making the time to talk to our listeners here about your story, about what happened. Tell me first, September 2nd, what happened on September 2nd?
Well, Jason, September 2nd, I was summoned to my front gate. I heard sirens up there. They were just doing the little whoop-whoops, and we live on property, and it's 11 acres, and we live at the back of the property. So I'm accustomed sometimes to people coming up and blowing their horn at the gate. Nobody ever comes in my gate because that's just a way people live in my area. If the gate's closed, you don't come in. So I kind of like that. It keeps us pretty private. But I heard the commotion up at the front gate, so I got in my golf cart. I drove up there. When I opened the gate, I saw two deputies, both of whom I knew. And I greeted them, and they said, Terry, we've got a warrant here. I said, okay, what's it about? And they told me. I asked them, well, are you arresting me? And they said, yeah, I'm afraid so. And it was a very cordial. There was no animosity. They weren't upset with me. I wasn't upset with them. I understand it's just business. And so I offered my hand so they could put the handcuffs on me. They put me in the car, and they drove me to jail. That's pretty much it. I did get a look at the warrant, the charges, before they put me in handcuffs. And what they charged me with is an interesting, rather obscure statute, state statute. It's the 843.0855. And they charged me with 10 counts. It's a third-degree felony charge. They told me that I could do as much as 50 years in prison for it. And the description of the charge is criminal actions under color of law or through use of a simulated legal process. They said also that I had impersonated a public officer. Now, I knew what they were talking about, but I certainly couldn't understand how this particular law applied to what I had been involved in.
Did they understand the charge? I mean,
no. In fact, nobody's been able to figure out what this charge means or why the charge even exists, and specifically how it applies to me and the position that I was in at the time.
Now, I kind of heard your story through some folks, and I've heard about this and been doing a lot of research and been reporting on this. Just a little bit of background here. You're a Vietnam veteran.
That's correct. When 1968-69, I spent a year in Vietnam. In Da Nang, Vietnam, yes.
And you swore an oath at that time to protect and defend the country.
Well, I swore the oath when I went into the military, which was in 1966, and I swore the oath to the Constitution.
You know, did that oath impact you? Why is this so important to you?
Well, you know, anybody that's gone into the military and goes through that induction process, they're stood up to swear the oath, and we all take the same oath. And at the time, I was 23 years old. I had some prior experience with military in college. I was in a ROTC Ranger outfit. And even before that, in high school, I went to a military academy. And I was familiar with the mindset, serving your country, doing what it took to secure the country and understanding the Constitution. And even though I wasn't fully aware, not as much as I am now, of what the Constitution meant or some of the things that it even contained, I still understood it was very, very important. An interesting point, and this may give you a little bit of understanding, better understanding. In 1959, I was in a military academy. I was 15 years old. In 1959, if you'll remember, around Christmas, Castro took over in Cuba. we had a lot of students in our school that were from Cuba. Their parents were diplomats and from the upper crust of Cuba, if you might take that as a description. Their families were quite well off, and a lot of them were very politically connected. At Christmas time, these students couldn't go home. We didn't find out till after that that their parents had been murdered by Castro. So, when we did find out, it was pretty impactful because these were friends of ours. These were people that we knew quite well and we lived with because, of course, it was a military academy. We had our own barracks. And it had a very strong impact on me. I understood what communism meant. It drove it home. I had, earlier in my life, of course, Khrushchev was the one who was banging his shoe on the podium and threatening that he would bury us. We went through all the usual stuff anybody who grew up in the 50s and 60s went through with the constant threat of world war and atomic war and entire human race being wiped out. And even though you try to get through your life every day and you distract yourself as much as possible from a lot of this, it still has an impact. It still is underlying everything as you do and everything that you think. And when I was 23 years old, I was inducted. I didn't really even know much about Vietnam. I was in college, and I was just doing the things I had to do to try to get through college and get out and get my life started. And when I did get my draft notice, I went to the induction station. This was in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Went through the induction process, and I was told that if I would enlist, I would have to stay in an extra year. They would send me to school, and I would do something besides just be cannon fodder in South Vietnam. Well, like I said, I didn't really know much about South Vietnam. It was barely ramping up at that point, but they scared me. And so I enlisted for an extra year, and they sent me to Army Intelligence School. But in the process of induction, of course, I was required to take the oath. And I had taken it several times before ROTC college, and I'd taken it when I was in the military academy. It was just something everybody did. And each time I took it, I thought about it a little bit more. It went a little bit deeper in me. And the thing that really drove it home was when I was in Vietnam. And I was stationed in Da Nang, which is up in the I Corps area, up near the demilitarized zone. We saw quite a bit of action up there, but I didn't see that much. I mean, I could see it from where I was stationed, but I wasn't directly involved. And I had an opportunity to do some thinking about why I was there. I also had a lot of opportunity to think about the government that sent me there and the motivations behind it, the justification for why I was there. Now, this may sound a little strange, but I began probably my life in philosophy from that point. I saw myself as being used by the government. I heard the news that was coming back from the States that the people was getting. But I saw the reality on the ground in Vietnam. The contrast was shocking at times. The events that I saw happening around me, I saw how distorted they were by the time they got to the people in the United States. And it really bothered me. Probably the first time in my life that I had really started to mistrust anything that came out of Washington, D.C.,
You didn't dismiss it at the time as technology and it's difficult to get word across the ocean. You saw it as purposeful?
Well, yes, I did. I'll give you a for instance. One particular instance that occurred was we had problems in the field in Vietnam. We had troops that were dying as they laid by their M16s, trying to take it apart and clean it so they could fire it again because they kept jamming. The military came back and said there was no problem with those weapons, yet we were watching bodies, truckloads, bodies stacked like cordwood in body bags, driving over to the naval base where the airport was and being loaded on planes and shipped back to their families in the United States. And we had a Marine general sitting on his lard butt in the Philippines, telling the people in the United States that there was nothing wrong with the weapons they were giving us to use. That really stuck with me. I thought, we're living this over here, and the people in the United States are living under lies by our military and by our political representatives. That really drove a point home to me.
With their accomplices in the media.
Well, you know, the media, if I found this out a little later. Everybody, Walter Cronkite was everybody's father during that time. Everybody listened to him. Whatever he said was gospel. He was a traitor. He committed treachery of such a level against our country, against our people, because he got on the television and he lied. He told people when I got there right after Tet, and he was telling people that we had lost. We had been completely decimated by Tet. And I was there just a few weeks after Tet had happened. None of the things that he was describing on his nightly news broadcast did I see. Our morale was high. Actually, there was a book came out many years later by a North Vietnamese general. And he said that the North Vietnamese were ready to surrender because they had been so damaged, so destroyed by Tet. The only thing that kept them in the battle was what they heard from American TV, from Walter Cronkite.
Wow. Wow. So after the war, when you came back, what was the reaction?
Well, this was 1969 when I came back, and we were all baby rapers and drug addicts, and it was the attitude toward anybody in uniform. We were told by the Army, do not wear your uniform once you get back in the States. They told us that we would be in danger because the public so much hated the people who were serving over there because of the media that we would be attacked, we'd be spit on, there'd be all kinds of problems. And there were, I did see a little bit of that when I got back, but most of us were in our civvies by the time we got off the plane. But anybody with a short haircut at that time was considered the enemy. And I didn't understand at the time. I had just gotten married probably 11 months before I was shipped to Vietnam. So I came back. I had my new wife. I had a new life. I was out of the military at that point. It took me probably about 6 months to kind of get my feet back under myself and get a direction. But everything that I saw, everything that I did, came right back to the same problem. And it always came back to the duplicity of government creating the problem that I had. And let me make this clear. I don't have a problem with our government in that sense. And I'm sorry I used that word that way. I have a problem with our bureaucracy. Our government is our government. It's designed by some of the most brilliant men that have ever walked this planet. Our government is about as near perfect as anything created by man could be. Our problem is we've got people that have infiltrated our government. I call them bureaucrats. You can call them communists. Anything you want to call them, it probably applies. But that's where our problem lies. That and the fact that the people have, for the most part, gone to sleep in this country. And I can say this because I'm one of them. For 30 or 40 years, I raised my daughter. I lived my life. I am a husband. I'm a father. I worked hard. Many times I ran a business and worked. Sometimes I ran two businesses. I have always done everything I could to be a good person, a good citizen, and an American. But I've always kept one eye on the government. And I have learned that's what you've got to do to survive.
I oftentimes refer to what's going on in this country as an awakening. And if you would have asked me back February 2009 when we started the Tea Party movement, if you would have asked me specifically about the Constitution and the 17th Amendment or specific things, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. I just knew something was wrong and I had to do something. But since that time, I've dug in and rolled up my sleeves and learned so much about it, about the proper role of government, about the way it's supposed to work. When you took your oath to the Constitution, did you fully understand it as you do now, or did you have an awakening, over time?
Well, Jason, similar to you, I started waking up around 2008 and getting actively involved. I was aware. I had had dealings with the IRS in my business, and I was just completely dumbfounded by how they came in, like the stormtroopers, and just took over.
And you have to prove your innocence as opposed to the way it's supposed to work.
Very definitely. And anyhow, I'd had my problems with them. I had solved my problems with them. They took way more than their pound of flesh from me without justification. It was they saw that they could get that much from me, and they took it. And that taught me a bit about government. During the Clinton administration, I really started looking closely at what was going on, how every time Bill Clinton would get himself in a little bit of trouble, he'd go bomb an aspirin factory in Africa. And it's like I was watching all of this. I was watching the Bimbo eruptions. I was watching Monica Lewinsky. I was watching him sell our military aircraft designs to China. All of these things that were going on at that time, all the people that were around him that might have come forward and told the truth about him suddenly disappeared. They died under mysterious circumstances. Yet most of the country was not looking at this. And I could not figure out how. Why weren't they seeing the same thing I was seeing? When Hillary was ready to put people who worked for the travel office, the White House travel office, she was willing to put them in prison for nothing other than the fact that they held a position that one of her friends wanted from Arkansas. I saw outright larceny, duplicity, treason, everything during that administration. And it really frustrated me that nobody was doing anything about it, that he could lie like that and just walk away.
You're using terms that seem like legal terms. But we've been trained that accountability and consequences of those kind of actions, that we the people, we can only offer our consent to the governs and hold them accountable every 2 years in an election. That we have to wait for that. But let's get into your case about how we got to where we are today, because through your education, through you understanding the Constitution, specifically the Fifth Amendment, specifically the grand jury and the presentment power, which nobody really knows what that is today, let's talk about how you ended up being arrested on September 2nd.
September 2nd was more or less the culmination of my experience with the grand jury process. Back around April 21st, I was selected as a grand jury, on the grand jury in Dixie County.
Well, you're
Florida.
Summoned for jury duty.
Yeah, I was called in. I was summoned in. I had no idea. I thought it was just regular jury duty. I'd served on a couple of juries before. I always enjoyed it. I always learned a lot from it.
But what's interesting, most people, jury duty. Oh, yeah. They don't want to do it. They don't understand how important it is.
Well, I look at it from being it's my duty. If my fate were going to be put in the hands of a jury, I would want somebody to take it as seriously as I did. and to understand really what the process is. We've all been inundated with these jury decisions from different trials that have gone on. O.J. Simpson's probably the most depressing one. But anyhow, we look at it and we say, I can't be that stupid. I can't be that disregarding of people's feelings, rights, and the law. If I ever get on a jury, I'm going to be smart about it. I'm going to listen to what's going on. I'm going to make a wise decision. And it's one of the decisions that I made in this. And as I said, I've been on a jury a couple of times. I was on a federal jury on a criminal case, and I was on a civil case in the county. And I learned so much from both of those experiences. I was really looking forward to being on the jury. And when we were called up there, they started bringing up people that had qualified, and I had qualified across the board. Now, I am over 70 years of age, and I had the option of just walking away, and I didn't do that. I said, this is my job. This is my duty. I can treat somebody with respect and give them justice on the jury, and that's the attitude I took. Well, when they got up to 21 people on the jury, I thought it a bit strange because every other jury I had been on was 12, maybe one or two alternates. When they got up to 21, I was totally confused. I couldn't figure out what kind of a jury it would be. And the state attorney came in front of us, and he said, okay, I'll explain to you what's going on here. You're on the grand jury. And this will last for 6 months. Don't worry about it. Chances are you'll never see us or hear from us again. It's unless somebody murders somebody. You'll only be called up if it's a capital crime. And that's just a formality. Usually we'll tell you everything you need to know, and you just vote, and that way we're in constitutional compliance. Well, that seemed to rest well with most of the people on the jury. They seemed to be relieved that they wouldn't be bothered again. But it bothered me that he framed it in that manner. Now, I didn't know much about grand juries. I had seen them on television a couple of times. I've heard references made to grand juries, but I didn't understand how they worked or anything about them. The judge at that time did go through the instructions, and I listened very carefully to what she said. And the instructions went on for probably 8 or 10 minutes. Quite a few pages. And there were a few of the instructions that really stood out to me, but most of them kind of got lost in the fog of her reading them and the thoughts that were going through my head as she was reading. When I got home, they did ask for a volunteer for foreman, and I held my hand up. So they made me foreman of the statutory grand jury for the next 6 months. When I went home, rather than just forgetting about it, as it was suggested by the state attorney, I got on my computer and I downloaded the instructions and I read them again. I picked out a few more things that I hadn't really caught the first time through, and a few of the other points in there really drove home. And I said, well, wait a minute. I think I volunteered for something more than I thought. I looked at all my responsibilities in there about how I had to keep an eye out for any kind of criminality in the community, that I had to entertain any suggestion from anybody in the public that approached me with consideration for what kind of allegations they were making. Had to consider it. Is this worthy of an investigation by the grand jury? Is this something that the community really needs to be looked into?
So your grand jury instructions said those things?
Oh, yes, very, very much so.
But verbally, they said, don't worry, we won't call you unless there's a murder.
That's where they put us, put our mindset, was the fact that, okay, don't pay any attention to this stuff because it doesn't really matter.
And that's Dixie, the way they present it. We're in Dixie County, Florida here.
Correct.
How many times has the grand jury convened in Dixie County, Florida?
Well, it's supposed to be done every 6 months. I don't know how true they are to that schedule, but the every county in the state is supposed to have a grand jury in effect, change them every 6 months, and that's it. They're to be there in the event something happens that they're needed. And that does fulfill the constitutional requirements. I did find out that there's a number of states in the union that don't even bother with it. And a little bit later, I found out there's a number of counties in the state that don't even bother with it because they never call the grand jury. The state attorney always works around it, so he doesn't have to be bothered with grand juries. But the thing that struck me on this was I picked up my little pocket constitution and I was looking at it. It seemed somewhere in there I had remembered grand jury being mentioned. And I went through the constitution. I went through all the branches and the requirements and so forth and didn't find it.
Articles and, 1, 2, and 3, legislative,
that's right. I went through
executive, judicial.
Absolutely. I said, well, it's got to be probably in the judicial branch because that's where we were with the statutory, was under the judiciary. And I didn't find it. And I thought, well, I'll run through the Bill of Rights real quick. And as I was scanning through it, I had always equated the Fifth Amendment with not being forced to self-incriminate and the double jeopardy part. And I said, well, okay, I remembered it from that. And but when I read the first part of it, where no person could be held for a capital or otherwise infamous crime except by a presentment, which I didn't understand the word, or indictment by a grand jury.
And we've all heard the word indictment.
Well, indictment comes from the state attorney, and I learned that the presentment was that's when the grand jury finds a case on its own or presents a case on its own. That's the presentment, and that kind of makes sense. So I understood that part. When I read it, I said, oh, my God, wait a minute now. If no man, no person can be held on a capital or otherwise infamous crime, and then I had to look up infamous crime because I had never heard of an infamous crime outside the Fifth Amendment. So I looked it up. An infamous crime is one where the penalty can cost a man or a woman their liberty or their treasure. In other words, if they can spend time in jail, if they can be required to pay a fine, that's an infamous crime. And I said, what's going on here?
It's absolutely
like, I don't ever hear of anybody going before a grand jury for a traffic ticket or a DUI or anything. I don't understand this. And I started digging a little bit deeper, and I said, is it possible that our courts, under law, are not obeying the law? The further I dug into it, the more I realized that our courts are not even under the law. No, I didn't know the difference.
What in the world does that mean? What do you mean they're not under the law?
Well, I'll tell you. And it took some research. I took this very seriously. I mean, I did some digging on this. Thank God I'm in a position where I can spend some time digging around and finding this stuff out.
And because you took this seriously.
Absolutely.
Foreman's kind of a big deal.
Well, yeah, I had the responsibility of the whole jury and making sure that everything was done properly and within the requirements of the statutes.
And you didn't make that up. That's part of your instructions.
Well, I've got it not only in my instructions, but I've got it in the jury handbook, which is produced by the Supreme Court of the state of Florida, which sounds like it might have a little bit of leverage, and by the 905 statutes in the state of Florida. And those statutes are very specific about a lot of the duties and the requirements and the responsibilities of the grand jury. And through reading all of this stuff, I understood the impact of what I had volunteered to do and I had been called upon to do, and which I took an oath to do. The grand juries are sworn in again, just like everybody else is, and they're sworn to do specific things within the parameters of the grand jury, which I did. And I did everything I could to meet those requirements.
Yeah, so you're looking up at these different words, and one thing I'm writing in my book is I talk about how words have changed. I mean, you can look for a word today and find a bunch of different definitions from different sources. And if you look up the same word, sometimes in those same sources 100 years ago, the definitions have changed. So even an infamous crime, for example, one of them, Cornell Law, you know, their Google search results seem pretty high. And they just said infamous crimes could be fraud and dishonesty, just in a simple sentence.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually when you think about a grand jury, you think about capital crime, you think murder, you know, an indictment, you know, a prosecutor can indict a ham sandwich. So that's where a state attorney or state prosecutor brings evidence to the grand jury, and the grand jury votes whether or not they believe there's enough evidence to then go to trial, to then be determined guilty or innocent.
Yeah.
Most people today, they hear, oh, indictment, oh, somebody did something wrong. Well, there may be evidence, but it's going to be now tried by a jury of your peers.
Mm-hmm.
The importance of the grand jury is where it is us, we the people, making that determination. And so when you talk about the word presentment can be initiated by that grand jury, if a member of the public approaches the grand jury, or if the grand jury they themselves are made aware of, it's their duty per their oath, per the grand jury instructions, per the handbook, per the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, to begin an investigation.
Well, I think that's the part that a lot of people don't realize, that the grand jury has incredible breadth of what they can do to determine if there's enough evidence to warrant a full investigation and possible prosecution by the state attorney or district attorney, depending on the state that you're in. And that's the confusing point. We have all of this latitude in the way we approach and the way we gather information and what we can do with witnesses and the determinations, the deliberations and determinations that we make. Because what we do is present an indication or allegation of criminality. That's all. That's the thing that's neat about it, is that we can't sentence anybody to death, or even we can't even take away their liberty.
You can't even say that they're guilty.
That's correct. There is no guilt or innocence kind of determination. Now, I kind of hesitate to use the term innocence, because none of us are innocent, but guilt or not guilt. And that's not our point. Our point is to basically say to the state attorney, we smell smoke. Could you please check and see if there's a flame here? That's it. It's not like we have this awesome power. Now, we have broad ranges of authority in this. We can look into things that the police can't look into. We can do things the state attorney can't. But there's not the consequence that those people create.
Now, through our research, we found an article from 1901 in Manatee County, Florida, where the Manatee County grand jury did a full audit. And they put it in the newspaper. They did a full audit of their government. They said the courthouse needs more space. The sheriff's office needs cleaning. There's $9,000-some-odd missing in the audit. Any indication that your grand jury is supposed to do that?
Well, there is certainly nothing in the instruction that would tell us that that was part of our duty. They said in the instructions that we had the authority to do that, and that's correct. However, there was no instruction to do it. And that's the thing that I kind of felt we were shortchanged on. And that's why everybody else on the jury except me, I guess, went home and forgot about it. So that's where we ended up. That's how this whole journey started. I was home. I was reading all of this stuff, and I said, there's got to be more to this than they presented when we were seated. And that's when I started looking at the next step. I wanted to see how valid the assertion was that we could get information from the public and use it as something to consider as an issue in front of the grand jury. One of the things that I saw there was that anybody from the public could approach me, present a concern, and this could be done verbally, present a concern, and then I could take that to the grand jury. So I thought, okay, fine. But how does anybody in the public, since my identity is required to be secret, how does anybody in the public know I'm even alive, that the grand jury even exists? I never knew. I've been living in Dixie County for 3 years. I didn't know there was a grand jury there. I never even thought about it.
And never even thought about the fact that the grand jury can hear things from the public. I mean, we're told, well, if you think there's criminal activity, go tell the sheriff. Well, what if you believe there's criminal activity with the sheriff's office? Where are we supposed to have that outlet?
Well, that's true. And the other point is, what if there's criminality and there's complaints about how the court does its business? How do you take allegations of criminality to the court? So it didn't make sense to me that the statutory grand jury, which was under the direction of the court and under absolute control, as I found out later, of the state attorney. How do you take your concerns to anybody there and have any confidence that they will be well served? And what I did was essentially took an envelope, and I wrote on the envelope, for the eyes only of the grand jury foreman. I sent it to myself by the clerk of court there in Dixie County, and I waited for the clerk to call me. Now, I sent it return receipt requested, so I know that it was received by the clerk's office. But in, it's been 3 months now, 4 months since that happened. I still don't have that envelope. And as many times as I'd been in the clerk's office at the courthouse, she never mentioned it. Well, that bothered me a bit. Another thing that we're required to do on the grand jury is to work or cooperate with grand juries in neighboring counties if there's criminality detected or alleged that's common to both counties, if it transcends the county line. And I thought, well, this will be interesting. I'll contact the clerk of court in the next county and tell them that I'm the foreman of the grand jury, give them my phone number, and ask them to have their grand jury foreman contact me because I have information of felonies being committed in their county that they need to be aware of. I did this with two counties, two neighboring counties.
Now, this isn't something you made up. This is something you got from the instructions in the handbook that you have that duty to do.
No, it's a requirement.
Yeah.
It says that we are duty bound to cooperate with any other grand jury in the state in the event criminality transcends our common borders or our borders. It could go three counties, four counties. I could go to Miami if there was something going on there that the grand jury in Miami needed to know. So
right.
That's not the main thing is to create this network, this web of the people. So that the people can communicate and let this get across to make sure that the people were looking at this across their common borders and that it was not being corrupted or perverted by government or corrupt government officials. See, that's one of the things I learned was going back and looking at the Magna Carta, which is a constant reference with anything doing with the grand jury. I think that's the first time it was ever documented. And their whole purpose was to act as a buffer. The grand jury of, by, and for the people was a buffer between them and corrupt, overbearing government officials or overzealous prosecutors. That was a way for them to say, now, wait a minute, you're out of line here. We're going to protect our people. These allegations are not well-founded. They could actually stop an investigation by law enforcement at that time, and that's the way it's been for the last 800 years.
Now, you just used the word buffer, and fast forward to 1992, U.S. versus Williams, Antonin Scalia, writing for the majority, talked about the grand jury being outside of the three branches of government, and he said, acting as a buffer or referee between the government and the people, is a direct quote.
That's absolutely correct. That's the way it was interpreted by him, and that's the way it's been used, like I said, for 800 years. The problem is, over the last 150 years here in America, the grand jury has been subverted. It's been turned to a different purpose. It's been subjugated under the courts and under the state attorneys so that they now control that as a tool to get done whatever they want to do.
So is there some sort of amendment in the Constitution past the Fifth Amendment that changes the Fifth Amendment?
Well, no.
We know the answer to
no,
that.
No, and the Fifth Amendment is still in effect if our Constitution's indeed in effect. It's not very well respected by a lot of people in the bureaucracy, but it's still there, and it's still waiting for the people to stand up and support it. I think the weakest point we've got right now is the people enforcing their own rules, their own laws. And that's why I am where I am now.
So you were talking about the different counties, and you can't just go on the, you know, Lee County website and find out who the grand jury foreman is. So if you're aware of criminal activity that affects them and you need to communicate with them, how are you supposed to do that?
I went to the county clerks in two different counties. Neighboring counties. I told them that I was the grand jury foreman. Now, I can reveal my identity, and the identity of the foreman is public because I have to sign any true bills of presentment that come out of the grand jury. So my name will be recognized. It will be publicized if we produce a true bill. So I do have that flexibility, and that's unique in the grand jury. I told them I was the foreman of the grand jury. I gave him my phone number. I said, I'm not asking you to reveal to me what the grand jury foreman's name is in your county. Just give them my name and my phone number. Ask them to call me because I have evidence of felonies going on in your county. And it's important. Well, I didn't get a response from either one of them. Now, this is an interesting point. This may seem like a side point, but I had just notified a constitutional officer, this is in two different counties, of criminality, of felonies, and they did nothing. Nobody contacted me. The state attorney didn't contact me. The foreman of the other grand juries didn't contact me. Nothing. Now, that in itself is a felony. In other words, for a public officer to receive information of felonies going on in their jurisdiction and to do absolutely nothing is called misprision of felony, yet they did nothing. That's a felony that could put them away for over a year. It could cost them tens of thousands of dollars in fines. They did nothing. That was shocking to me. But that's where I was with it. I knew that what the state told me about what a grand jury could do was a lie. And that really bothered me. My next step then was to take the allegations, the ones that I reported to these other counties, take those allegations, put them into written form, and prepare them to be presented to the grand jury, which I did. I contacted the county clerk. I said, I need you to call the grand jury together. I've got a case I'd like to present to them or an issue. It's not a case until an indictment is issued. And I want to present it to them and see what they think. And if they think there's something here, then it'll be taken to the state attorney where he can write draft the true bill and then consider it for an indictment from his office. And that's when things started going downhill. The clerk of court would not convene the grand jury. She had to get the permission of the state attorney. At least that's what she said. The state attorney called me. He didn't much like the fact that I was calling the grand jury, his grand jury together, as he said it. I finally convinced them that this was important, that I had the information I needed, and that I was prepared to present it. And he relinquished and called the grand jury.
Now, the state prosecutor did.
The state attorney, prosecutor, it's the same thing depending on what position he's playing at the moment. So, yes, that's who it was. So I got in about a two-week period, I believe it was.
So I read somewhere that you asked them to make sure when they brought them together that everybody had some information. And what was that information?
I asked them. I said, number one, we were not given the instructions other than verbally when we were seated. Number two, we've never received a copy of the grand jury handbook. And at that time, he said, oh, my goodness, you were supposed to have gotten all that stuff. I'm really sorry. I'll make sure they get it. And I said, there's one more thing I need you to do. I've got a short letter, an instruction to get to the grand jury. And if you're going to be mailing this out, I want you to do this. I want you to enclose a copy of the Constitution and Bill of Rights. And I want you to put this letter in there that instructs them to read, understand, and commit to comply with each of the documents. That was the instructions, the handbook, and the Constitution. And he agreed to do that. When I got my copy of that information, it contained the instructions in the rule book or the handbook, but not the Constitution. And my instructions to read these so that the people would be prepared and understand what their responsibilities and authorities were was missing. So when we met, and we were scheduled for 1:30 in the afternoon, which was nowhere near enough time to make this presentation, nobody was prepared. And I told them so when I came there, and I explained to them that I had asked that this to be done, and since it wasn't done, there was no way we could make any kind of a deliberation or even present the case that day.
So you walk into that first meeting. Who was there?
Well, the people that were there were the state attorney, his assistant, a court reporter, and a bailiff. Now, in a grand jury, if you're not familiar with them, a grand jury meeting, no one is to be there but the grand jury. And this is to protect the information that they're going to be deliberating or being presented and to minimize the possibility of people spreading secrets. Well, with all these extra people in there, I explained to the state attorney that we were not going to be having any witnesses that day. I was just giving them some information, and there would be no interrogation. There's no need to swear anybody in, and we certainly weren't going to be presenting a true bill to be drafted. So with all of that, I asked him to leave, and he refused. And I explained to him that this is creating a problem because I have information that I need just the grand jury. They've been sworn to secrecy on this, and now I've got all these other people in the courtroom plus four armed sheriff's deputies standing outside the courtroom. I said they could be seen, by the way, by everybody in the courtroom. Another thing that the state attorney did was he had the grand jury, once we were collected in the peanut gallery of the court, he had them all move up to the petty jury box, something I would never have done because it creates a completely different mindset. And I wanted to keep the grand jury on a very informal level, and he turned it into his grand jury, which he repeated several times. And I asked him at one point, I said, "Jeff, if this is your grand jury, why am I here?" And his response was, "Yeah, I'm kind of thinking the same thing, too." Well, he maintained control of the grand jury through the whole process, not only in a lengthy introduction, not only by calling every grand jury member prior to the meeting, and what he said, preparing them for the meeting. I don't know what that was supposed to mean or why they had to be prepared. But he definitely had their mindset established when they walked into that room.
Grand jury instructions, I think 7.2 talks about the fact that you're supposed to make sure that the meeting is conducted in an orderly fashion.
That's correct. And I'm also the single contact point for anyone who cannot appear on the date that's requested. He had called them ahead of time to make sure that they were going to be there. And that's when he and I kind of got into it, that I said, "Jeff, you know, you won't even share with me these people's names." He said, "Well, their names are secret. You don't need to know. This was my grand jury. They needed to know my name and my phone number so they could contact me if they had any questions or problems." Yet he would not share that. He kept control of it all the way through. I couldn't contact them. I couldn't even verify if the people who came to that meeting were actually members of the grand jury. He let whoever walked into that room go up and get into that jury box. Any member of the public could have walked in there at that time. I would not have had any control over it. So the other way he kept control over the jury is while I was preparing the grand jury, explaining to them the basis for these allegations, he stood behind me and to my right. I noticed that the grand jury kept looking at him. As I was speaking, their eyes would cut over to him. And at one point, I turned my head quickly, and I thought, "Well, what are they looking at?" He was behind me using hand signals and facial expressions and cueing the jury of how to react to what I was saying, or he was mocking what I was saying. Well, I realized at that time that he had never relinquished control to me, and I quickly brought that session to an end and required a follow-up session so I could present the actual issues that we were going to be dealing with. And after that, I went over and I talked to him, and I said, "Jeff, I don't appreciate the way you did this, and I'm very concerned that this jury has been corrupted." His thing was, "It doesn't matter. It's my jury. I'll handle it the way I want to." I went home. That was a Friday evening. I went home and I spent the weekend drafting a 7-page explanation to the seating judge and delivered it to her on Monday. I handed it to her. She didn't even bother to look at it. She just laid it down on her secretary's desk and walked away. I found out that she had been replaced by the chief judge, who was in another city, another county. And this was the first time I'd known about it. I had had no contact with him. I really didn't even know his name. But I found out that she was no longer the presiding judge over the grand jury. The only way I felt like I could get any protection on what had happened and get it registered so that there would be a complaint somewhere as to what had been done, I filed a copy of my presentation to the seating judge with the clerk of court. Because there were criminal allegations in the writing that I had done, I took a copy to the sheriff's department and asked that he be given that copy. And I waited. There was nothing much I could do. It was going to be 2 weeks before the next session. And I was waiting for somebody to respond to the report that I had made. And I got nothing. 7 days later, I received a letter from Judge Greg Parker through Jeff Siegmeister, the state attorney. This is the one that I had been complaining about. Greg Parker asked him to send me a letter because he didn't know how to get in touch with me. And the letter basically chastised me for not reaching out to him when I had problems with Siegmeister. Now, I had no idea this man was even alive, let alone know that he was in the courthouse in Dixie County at the time the grand jury was having that meeting on August 1st.
Coincidentally.
Not coincidentally, intentionally. I found out later why. And I also found out why the seating judge, her name was Judge Munkittrick, why she was taken off the grand jury roll. I'll get into that a little bit later. But this whole thing appears to have been a setup. Nobody to this day has responded to me about any of the allegations I made, any of the concerns I have. They have completely ignored every bit of it. Now, I had still been given by a member of the public, I had been entrusted with criminal allegations by a concerned person in the community, and I had nowhere to take it. The statutory grand jury was blocked. It was corrupted. I declared it null and void in my letter to Judge Munkittrick because they had been corrupted. There was no way they could give any kind of a fair consideration to anything that I would present to them, and there was no way I could work with that.
And at this point, they're still not even interested in what the criminal activity was.
Oh, no, no, no. There was no concern. There was no inquiry. They weren't concerned about criminality. They were concerned about protecting their own. So I had heard about the common law grand jury, and I had looked into it a little bit. I thought, well, maybe this is a solution to the problem. At least I'll be able to turn these allegations from the public over to the common law grand jury, and perhaps they can do something about it.
And that makes sense because Florida is supposed to be a common law state.
Well, I know that in the Constitution, the United States, our country is a common law country. Our government is founded under common law. Mm-hmm. And the state of Florida in the Constitution states that it's a common law state. So I said, well, this is the obvious way to go. Well, we put together 25. I presented the case, and they deliberated and voted, and they decided to pass this on to the state attorney there were allegations against him in this also, but whoever was going to be in the state attorney's seat, that we considered the fact that there was enough evidence here that we want the state attorney to investigate, and if he deems it worthy to prosecute. That's what we did. We presented a true bill.
A true bill of presentment, which is the Fifth Amendment. It is your responsibility. It is the responsibility of the grand jury, the ability of the grand jury to initiate an investigation.
That's exactly right, Jason. And it was also my sworn duty by the oath I took before the statutory grand jury. Now, I didn't see that oath as being just for the statutory grand jury. It's an oath, and it's a solemn oath, and it deals directly, the way I saw it, with my responsibility to the people. It's very similar to the same oath I took when we seated the common law grand jury, or we called it the people's grand jury because it was of, by, and for the people.
And the issue there, you know, the statutory grand jury, we look at, and part of my research that I've been doing is, how is it formed, what instructions are you given, and then what functions do they perform? And so how it's formed is through the system, through their filter, and essentially what you did was you made these announcements, you had this town meeting, if you will, brought the people together, people of the people by the people. You elect jurors, and that is how it is formed. And then the instructions are given. You talk to people about common law. You talk to them about the Constitution, specifically the Fifth Amendment, the Magna Carta, centuries of examples, all the way through to 1992 U.S. versus Williams. You talk about all of those things to make sure they understand those things, which is supposed to be what our system of government is based upon. And then you presented evidence of criminal activity. They vote two true bills of presentment, one of them being...
It was against Siegmeister for what he had done in the grand jury session, because what he did were felonies. He committed at least 8 felonies in the way he corrupted the grand jury.
When I read the true bill, it was obstruction of justice and tampering
with the jury, correct. And the other true bill was on Common Core. And the bribery between the federal government, and it probably goes higher than that, all the way down to our local school board.
Because essentially that was based, race to the top funding was this. They dangle this federal dollars. I'm doing the finger quotes on the radio. These federal dollars. They will give you federal dollars, and then if you take Common Core, which wasn't even developed at the time.
That's what they've been doing for some time with a lot of the centralized control over our education system. And look, state attorney, you need to look at this from a criminal standpoint. Our governor had already signed the bill saying that we had to have Common Core. What we wanted to do was go back and take a look at the conditions, the circumstances under which we were forced to accept this program. Now, this is in violation not only of the United States Constitution, but also the Constitution of the state of Florida. And we're looking at this from the standpoint of, look, the people that we have operating our government that we've elected and that they have appointed are committing crimes, violations of our statutes, violations of our law, and nobody seems to be recognizing this.
If only we had a document that outlined what they're supposed to do, and if only we could get them before they take office to put one hand on the Bible, raise the other one, and swear an oath to protect and defend it. Wouldn't that be great if we could get them to do
that? Unfortunately, we have that document, but let me explain to you a little bit about it. This is another one of the things that caught my attention when I looked at Florida's DSDE 56. It's the elections form, oath of office. And this form, they take an oath to protect, defend, and uphold the United States Constitution and government and of the state of Florida. Now, the sentence in itself makes no sense. From the logic of it, just the sentence structure itself is illogical, but the logic of being able to give your oath to the Constitution and the government formed by that Constitution is contradictory. How can you pledge your allegiance to the superior and to the inferior at the same time? And how would you fulfill that?
So if the government does something that's outside the Constitution, doesn't matter. I'm swearing an oath to the government no matter what it does.
Well, it gives these politicians wiggle room. What they can do is say, what I did was against the Constitution, but over here it says I can do it for the government, and the government tells me to do something else, so I'm going to do what they say. Besides, they sign my paycheck. So this now we'll go back one more step here, and that is the Constitution of the state of Florida. Depending on what state you're in now, let me explain something to you about the Constitution of the state of Florida. It's a joke. It's a bowl of spaghetti. It is full of contradictions, not only against itself, but also against the United States Constitution. It defies logic and reason. People have been complaining about the Florida Constitution for decades, and they keep compounding the felonies that are intrinsic in that Constitution.
Hey, it starts off pretty good. Article 1, Section 1 says all political power resides in the people.
That's correct.
And it's downhill from there.
Absolutely. Yeah. We have mandates in there to put in high-speed rail. Now, why would high-speed rail have anything to do with the Constitution of the state of Florida? There's no relationship. That's our Constitution. This tells us how we're going to govern. And we've got high-speed rail, and there's other programs in there. Mm-hmm. It's been used as a depository for every little special interest project that every representative has ever come up there. It's an ego boost for them to be able to get some little something in that Constitution, and that's why it's such a mess.
So to the true bills of presentment, you file them with the Clerk of Courts August 15th, 4:31 p.m., stamped to receive by Clerk of Court Dana Johnson. They're in the system. Now, actually, I looked the other day, and when you search at myfloridacounty.com and you search for the documents, August 15th, 4:30 p.m., there's only a handful of documents filed that day in Dixie County. Two of them, the true bills, say unknown all across the board, and when you click on them, they're blank. Mm-hmm. Why are they blank?
Well, that's one of the questions we're asking. A little bit about this. One of the primary functions, the principal functions of the clerk of court is filings. It's important that they handle these filings so that people have a central repository for all of the valuable documents that can impact their lives. You could take anything in there. It'll be memorialized in there. It'll be filed. It'll be recorded. It will be as permanent a record as you can get on this planet. Yet, those two documents disappeared. And let me bring this up. For a clerk of court to refuse one of the people to file their document is a felony. It's punishable by up to 3 years in prison, plus fines. For them to remove a filed document is also a felony. So we're having some problems here with the clerk of court that can't do their job properly. And we've got influences beyond the clerk of court, because there's no way the clerk of court herself, this is Dana Johnson, there's no way that Dana Johnson would have any reason to remove those documents.
Even go back to August 5th, you talked about that document you filed earlier, a bill of information or something to that effect. Mm-hmm. That's blank and unknown on the website as well.
So what they've done is they've expunged from the official records, as I said, that's a felony, anything that I have filed in that court. Now, those things were in there.
And they are still there.
I
actually ordered them.
Yeah.
And I got a phone call, said, sir, you ordered some documents, and I'm looking at them, and they're actually just blank pages. Do you still want me to send them?
Well, that'll give you an idea of the depth of this conspiracy. We've got at least two judges, probably three at this point, a state attorney, a clerk of court, and a sheriff that are guilty of misprisions of felony. All of them felony charges. So we don't know where this is going at this point, but I know where I went.
Exactly. Let's lead into that for a moment. So these true bills of presentments are filed. The alleged crime of Siegmeister is the state attorney, is obstruction of justice, jury tampering. What does he do?
Oh, well, I received a letter from Judge Parker that I was removed from the statutory grand jury, based on an affidavit filed by Jeffrey Siegmeister.
So the document referred to it as a petition.
Yeah, he had filed a petition with the judge, and the judge sent me the letter. Now, the letter referred to the petition, but the petition was not attached. I sent a response to him stating that what he was alleging in his letter was not factual, and I required him to forward me a copy of Siegmeister's petition so I could see what Siegmeister was saying.
Where's the due process there?
Well, there is no due process, and this is the way they run, and this is the problem we've got with our courts. The court system, they're all about rules, yet they don't follow them. And they'll tell you right up front they don't have to. They are judges. They are state attorneys. They can make up the rules as they go along, unless, of course, they want to hold your feet to the fire over a rule.
So the people allege criminal activity, and those documents are blanked out.
Correct.
One guy of the system alleges activity.
Right.
And granted.
Everything is enforced.
Stamped.
Correct. So.
So not only is it enforced, but not only are you removed from the grand jury foreman position, what happens a few days later?
Well, on the 2nd of September, as I said, I had a couple of deputies come to my property And they took me to the jail. I was booked in on the charges. And I was left pretty much to sit there. I wasn't even booked until the following morning. Now, the excuse for that was that I refused to sign the paperwork, which I did.
Well, why would you?
Well, why would I sign the paperwork?
Right.
I had some serious concerns about the integrity and the intent of the judiciary at that point, and certainly the state attorney. And I had no idea, without benefit of counsel, and I had none at that point, I had no way to trust the documents that they were putting in front of me were what they even said they were. I wouldn't count on my own legal expertise.
And even that sentence right there, you didn't have the benefit of counsel.
No.
Just the fact that it's really highly recommended people don't enter that building without a lawyer, without counsel, telling them how to navigate this crazy building with all these crazy words and definitions and procedures that we, the people, don't understand. And we're not even taught these different things. Isn't it funny how lawyers go to law school and have an area of concentration of the law to study, but yet we, the people, have to follow all the law?
Well, Jason, I have to argue with you there. I don't think there's anything funny about it at all.
Amen.
It's not only sad, it's tragic.
It is.
And it's the way we've allowed, and I have to take responsibility for this. I have to take the responsibility that for 40 years of my life, I wasn't paying attention. I was so busy trying to do what I thought was right and what was expected of me that I didn't pay attention to those who weren't doing what was right and not doing what they was expected of them. That's where I went wrong. That's what I'm trying so hard to correct now. I want to give this a short encapsulation of this thing. I was called upon by my government to perform a duty. I swore to do that duty. I received a sacred trust from the public. I tried to carry that trust through exactly the way my government told me I had to do it. I did it step by step, and at every point, my government failed me. When I took it to the point where I wanted to fulfill my duty, I took this issue before a common law grand jury, a jury of my peers, a jury of 25 good and honorable people of the community, and they told me what to do with that from the standpoint of presenting it to the state attorney or legal authority for further investigation and prosecution if they so deemed it worthy. And then I was arrested for criminal actions under color of law or through use of simulated legal process. The charges don't even make sense. They don't make sense to me on their face, let alone any way it could be applied to what I did. I simply reported allegations of crime. I didn't create the allegations. In most of this, the only allegations I presented was what I knew as factual with what happened between me, the state attorney, and the grand jury, the statutory grand jury. That was it. All I did was give them information, give law enforcement information that they could follow up on, and I went to jail for it. I'm charged with 10 counts of a third-degree felony. Now, I don't know how long it's going to take to get to my arraignment.
There's no date set?
No date. They could have me twisting in the wind for 6 months or more. I don't know what their limitations are. I'm not an attorney. I would like to go investigate how this kind of thing is done, but I've been forbidden under the terms of my bond to go into a courthouse. Unless I am willing and able to pay an attorney retainer fee for this, I can't get any legal help. I don't qualify for a public defender. Now, all of these things, it's like I've been charged with a crime and forbidden to defend myself, and that's where I stand at this point.
How has this affected you? Besides, well, obviously frustrating you, but
it's,
I mean,
it is frustrating. It's disappointing. It's depressing to think that we've allowed our government to devolve to this level of corruption. That we've got so many people that we're paying outrageous amounts of money to, plus whatever they can take on the side, and they're not doing their job. I asked, there were two FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement investigators came to interview me, interrogate me for 2 hours. They accused me of being a domestic terrorist. They accused me of fomenting revolution. So anyhow, that's where I am at this point.
How is
I'm out on bond. I have a $5,000 bond, which I posted, and I'm waiting, just twisting in the wind. My wife is having chest pains. She's having she has arrhythmia anyhow, and this is putting in her a constant state of agony. Our lives are put on hold. We can't do anything at this point. And we can't even get information out of the courts as to where this thing stands. They refuse to accept any motions from me. Now, I could submit motions demanding information from them, and maybe if they decided they wanted to, they might answer some of my questions and at least ease my mind somewhat on where I stand. But I have been forbidden to go to the courthouse. The court clerk of court has told me that she has been instructed not to accept any filings from me on any matter for anything at any time. So this is what we've allowed our courts to sink to.
In your personal life, you walk around town and your friends and...
Well, I'm finding out who my true friends really are, and I've got some good ones, and I'm making more every day. That's the gratifying part of it. But there's people that I was quite friendly with. I'm quite out in the community. A lot of people know me. I volunteer for anything anybody needs help with. I'm active in a number of organizations in the community. I know a lot of people. And there are people now that I thought were my friends that when I come out of a store and meet them, it's like, hi, Terry. They turn their eyes and they walk on past. I am, in their eyes, a convicted felon. I don't think a single one of them could tell you what I was charged for, but they know I was arrested on felony charges. I might as well be a rapist or a bank robber or something else because I've been branded criminal. This causes a great deal of discomfort and pain in both my life and my wife's life. Her physical manifestations of the pressures created by this. I don't know where this is going to go. I've been told that I will be killed, that the politicians are not going to let me get away with this. I will disappear and nobody will know what happened to me. I've been told that they'll burn my house down as a warning to back off. I don't know. I'm my whole life is on hold at this point. Our finances are sinking rapidly because I can't get out and do the things that I would normally do. It's costing me a great deal of money. I'm traveling around and I'm doing speaking engagements before people, but there's no money in that. They want to know what's going on. I want them to know what's going on. I spend most of my time on the computer searching, trying to get information as to how I'm going to be able to defend myself. I don't have the money to throw $10,000, $15,000, $20,000. I mean, to get an attorney to represent me, they're talking $20,000. And if this goes to trial, they want another $30,000, $40,000, or $50,000. They put no cap on it. My wife and I are retired. We're 70 years old. I don't have the resources to fight this, and they know it. And they're using that as a way to destroy me. And they're doing a very good job of it at this point. I don't know where we're going with it. It's just day by day. And if it weren't for friends that are out there that are standing by me, if it weren't for new friends that are contacting me on a daily basis by email and by telephone and letting me know that they're supporting, they're behind me, they're giving me information, they're trying to help, I don't think I could do this at all. But this has been a devastating experience. And when you try so hard to do the right thing and then you get kicked down like this by the very people that you voted for, and I voted for Jeff Siegmeister, by the way, and the people that you pay outrageous amounts of money to, and this is the way they repay our commitment to them. So that's where it stands at this point.
Terry, I want to thank you so much for sharing all that, and I'm going to encourage my listeners to pray for you, especially Ephesians 6, the full armor of God.
I definitely need that. I appreciate it. My wife, too. This is a true test, and I have faith that we'll come out of this, but the enduring it at this point is quite a burden.
Thank you.